John McCain has a history of using bad language. Well, so do I, but bad language on, you know, on the Senate floor, and he's been known to get angry enough to throw telephones at people. And I don't know if I want to give the big red button to that guy.
Oh, come on now. We heard that about Reagan. It's like, oh, don't want his hand on the button. You know what? It's not that easy, and he's not that stupid.
I'm just saying, he has a lot of temper tantrums, and I'm not actually...
So what? You're not going to blow up the world because you didn't get your muffins?
Welcome to You Are the Guest, a weekly show where you can be the guest and tell people what you and your friends and neighbors think about news events and issues of the day. It's part talk show, part opinion poll, part reality show, and a whole lot of fun. And it's completely dependent upon your participation as a guest. To be considered as a guest for a future show, check out the website at www.youaretheguest.com for details. Now here is your program host, Bill Grady.
Greetings from the great city of Fort Dodge, Iowa, and welcome to show number 94 of You Are the Guest, the show where we talk to everyday people just like you and me about their lives and about the issues of the day. Our guests today are returning guests from RizWords. Mark and Art, welcome once again to You Are the Guest.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Hey.
Doing good. How are you guys?
We're doing all right, I think.
Yeah, we're getting by, even though we're not doing any podcasting these days. We seem to be surviving.
So what are you doing now that you're not podcasting?
The reason for the hiatus on the podcast is that Mashable.com has me working about 13 hours a day as associate editor over there at the social networking news blog. So I've been pretty busy with that. Art's been bugging me to get us going with podcasting again, so we're
edging back into it. Yeah, this freelance work I've been doing just doesn't pay that often. So I'm looking for better stuff. You don't make a lot of money building computers for people, let's put it that way. There's very low margins in that. So constantly looking for more gainful employment.
And you're thinking podcasting is that? I mean, can you really make a lot of money doing podcasting, or you're back kind of amongst the working poor?
Well, I would like to be able to make more money from podcasting simply because of my disability, and there are limited things I can do. So it's really hard for me to do any kind of, backbreaking work in the workforce. And it's really tough to get into the stuff that Mark got into because you have to be in the right place at the right time. And for whatever reason, he seems to be in the right place more often than I am. So that's kind of how that works out. Not that I'm complaining, it just seems to be the way that it is.
Well, we're very happy to have you back, and we got a lot of political stuff to talk about, so let's go ahead and get into it. Topic number one, is there going to be a Democratic bloodbath between Hillary and Obama?
Well, you haven't noticed one already. They don't really get along all that well.
Yeah. Well, the first casualties of the bloodbath were the Kucinichs and the Gravels, but it's really starting to get serious now.
Was that a bloodbath?
They decide to have a love fest like they did at that, a CNN so-called debate?
Yeah, they have. Said,
yeah, but was that a bloodbath or was that just kind of a mercy killing with some of those guys?
Kind of a milk bath, if any kind of bath.
I don't know if they had all those other candidates there just to balance the weight of the stage out or what, because the five or six of them, however many there were, they had absolutely no business being up there. Not that Hillary or Obama could run the country any better or worse than they do. It's just that nobody knows who those other guys were, and nobody cares.
But they'd raised a lot of money.
Yeah, it's easy to raise a lot of money, though, because you have to remember their core constituencies in Hollywood. And they're people with a lot of money and no brain. So you dangle something shiny in front of them, and they'll go for it.
Well, that and the fact that, I mean, at least in Hillary's case, and for several of the candidates that are no longer in the race, it's real easy to make money or real easy to raise money for a candidate when your strategy is a Ponzi scheme with that Norman Shue character.
Go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry.
No, that's basically it. I mean, the guy would go out and, you know, sell shares in companies that didn't exist, and then, you know, take that money and spread it out to, you know, hundreds of people and have them donate the legal maximum to the Hillary campaign.
Yeah. So. Who knew that, you know, Chinese dishwashers had that much money? You know, who saw that coming?
Okay, John McCain rises from the dead.
And apparently his mother rose from the dead as well. But,
she is the biggest liability that campaign has, and that's the single most surprising thing, that it has risen from the dead despite her and her frequent appearances on Larry King.
Yeah, despite her Mormon bigotry, saying that Mormons, something like you can't trust a Mormon, and that said a bunch of stuff about Salt Lake City, and what else did she say? Oh, I don't believe my son has any support from the Republican base, so they'll just have to hold their nose and take him. And that is a ringing endorsement from your own mother, I will say that. Hold your nose and take my son.
And that's what you call parental revenge.
Yeah, something like that. It's really sad how we've gotten here, too. Mark and I have talked about this over and over. I remember a discussion that we had probably, it may have been 2004 or before that. We never thought we would get here. I remember we had the discussion, we're like, one or two more election cycles and the Democratic Party will be gone, just completely gone. And for some reason, all the Republicans said, oh, we're going to reach across the aisle and just govern as liberals. And now we all have our backs against the wall, and we've nominated, essentially, John McCain to be president of the United States, which makes absolutely no sense. We are completely back to square one, if not, you know, well before that. We've kind of screwed ourselves.
So Fred Thompson, hero or hypo?
Yeah, this is actually a kind of an emotional subject for Art, which is probably why he tossed it over to me. This was his guy. We really, you know, I made no secret of the fact that I pinned my hopes very foolishly on Ron Paul. Art did the same thing for Fred Thompson, and he sounded like the sane one of the two of us, and he still may be that, but the fact is that they both are more or less out of the race at this point, and I think we summed up our two candidates. Ron Paul could have had a real shot at it if he could have found his sanity. Fred Thompson could have had a shot at it if he could have found his pulse.
Yeah.
So what do you think he was thinking about? I mean, did he just kind of, because he was kind of like lackluster by the time he announced, right?
Well, I think that, I think that a lot of people have put into, to sort of look at it from a technology standpoint, I think some people have put too much faith into campaigning on the internet. And they said, well, you know, I don't have to go out and pound the pavement. I can just throw a video out on YouTube every few days and I'll be fine. You can do that, but you also have to, you know, outreach to the people. You can't just put a bunch of videos out and then, you know, roll into Iowa 2 days before the caucuses and expect to win, which is essentially what he did. And you can't do that. He may not have as much money as, say, a Mitt Romney, who, you know, visited every county in Iowa, but at the same time, you can't just blow it off. And I think Giuliani did the same thing. That's another discussion.
So if he was going to take the lazy man's way of campaigning, doesn't that also say he would have been a lazy president as well?
Well, they said the same thing about Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan took a lot of naps. It's documented. He napped a lot. He fell asleep at the cabinet table.
Yeah, but Ronald Reagan came to Iowa.
Yeah, but again, in 1980, we didn't have the internet to lull us into thinking, oh, we don't have to leave the house to be president of the United States.
That's right.
And I think
the lesson that really should have been taken away from this is, Ron Paul used the internet to his advantage in fundraising, so has Obama, for that matter, on the Democratic side.
Right.
The two candidates that have really seemed to get how to use social media and the internet to their advantage are the ones with the biggest bankroll. the ones that have tried to use it as their way to reach out and make a connection with the people have failed. Ron Paul, again, is a shining example of that. He let the people on Dig and the people in the blogosphere try to do his campaigning for him, and you know, it's translated into a whopping 6% of the vote. You know, whereas Obama combined the best of both worlds, campaigning on the internet for money, as well as campaigning in person for votes, and it's you know, we can see how that's worked out for him.
And it's funny, we laugh out about Ron Paul. You know, he had all this money, he had a ton of money, and what did he do with it? He bought a blimp.
He had a ton of money, as much as some of the other candidates, and 6 votes.
And I, Mark and I have, I think we agree, the majority of the reason he only got 6 votes was because he was a one-note samba. He would tie every problem in America to the war in Iraq, and that's just not the case. And he says he's a Republican, and he swears up and down about the party, and that's fine. But if you're going to say that, you better make an overture to appeal to the base. And with him constantly saying that the war is a debacle and we're losing and we're not going to win, and it's just been a mess, despite all this evidence to the contrary, that immediately turns everybody off, and that's why the majority, I think, walked away from him.
Is it still the economy, stupid?
Who wants to go first on that one?
You know, this is a topic that infuriates me, but also, in a lot of situations, silences me. Because the very thing that infuriates me about most of the talk that I see in the media and the blogosphere and just in general about the economy is the thing that makes me keep quiet about it. Because everybody likes to talk about it, but nobody's an expert. And for 6 months, we've been predicting and talking about how horrible the economy is in the face of all these other statistics that show the opposite. I mean, every statistical measure for the last 6 months has been coming, hey, maybe it's slowed growth, but we've had growth. Week over week, and yet everybody in the media is like, hey, you know what, we're in a recession, and guess what, now some of the numbers are turning negative and we are actually in a recession. And I've kept quiet on it because I don't want to be like the idiots that don't know what they're talking about, have no degree in economy, and still, you know, are making economic analysis. But now, I mean, it's to the point where I've got to say something. Like, come on, it's the economy, but why don't you ask an expert as opposed to, you know, just making up facts? Like, you see it in the New York Times, or all the way over in blogs like GigaOm, tech blogs. They like to talk about how we're in the middle of a tech bubble, which, again, also has no basis in reality either. But
Are we actually technically in a recession? Because a recession is defined by 2 consecutive quarters of economic decline. And
we're not technically in a recession, but we're seeing the first actual negative numbers
It's still a perceived recession. I don't know what the final number was. It was something like 52 consecutive months of economic growth, which has been unheard of in the history of the nation. And we still have people who would get on the news every day and say, "Oh, we're in a recession," and we're clearly not. I honestly think it all stems back to Bush derangement syndrome. They will completely ignore all the good that the president has done for what he can do for the health of the economy, and just hopefully, with all their negative drum beating, bring on a recession just so they can say, "Oh, look at this Bush economy, it's terrible, and look at the recession that we're in." They are hell-bent on making perception reality, and they've just about pulled it off. Go ahead.
No, that reminds me, and I think I brought this up on the show back, several months ago when I first heard it, but I was listening to Slate.com's podcast because I'm somewhat of a masochist, and they had this guy on who actually was some sort of economic analyst, and they were actually talking some hard numbers on what constituted a recession. There was when the subprime mortgage thing was just first starting to bubble up into the news.
Right.
And the guy's like, you know, of course it's Slate.com, so everybody's a liberal on the show. And the guy's like, I really don't know what I'm rooting for here. On the one hand, I don't want my entire retirement package to evaporate, you know, my 401ks to evaporate into nothingness because of the, you know, the subprime crisis that we're going to experience. But on the other hand, it's going to look really bad for Bush and the Republicans if it happens.
Yeah.
So I don't know who I'm rooting for. I'm like, you're an idiot. This is your future. This is your life, and you don't know who you're rooting for.
I will mortgage against my own future just so I can prove that George Bush, or attempt to prove that George Bush is an idiot, and it's his fault. That's how sad the whole thing is. And when you talk about the subprime crisis, nobody speaks of it honestly. They don't discuss the fact that Congress themselves caused this. They went to a bunch of lenders and they said, you have to make it easier for people to borrow money. You're being too stingy and you just don't care about those who want to own a home. It's their dream and you're not letting them do that. So they said, okay, we will let these people borrow money. And then they did, and this is where we're at. Now you have Congress saying, well, you're just a bunch of predatory lenders, and this is your fault, and we're going to make you pay. And beyond that, the mere thought that this is a crisis is ridiculous. 96% of Americans are still paying their mortgages on time. So I would hardly call that a crisis.
You want my spin on it?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Good economic times are always in the rearview mirror, no matter what.
Yeah, and that's a shame, too. Everybody always pines for the good old days, but I always went back to what my grandpa said. He goes, I don't understand this whole thing about the good old days. He goes, I was alive in the good old days, and guess what? Everybody was poor. I said, I was lucky to get an orange for Christmas, okay? Everybody was poor. He said, there was no such thing as the good old days. Life pretty well sucked. So the idea that, you know, that there were good old days and way back then it was easier is ridiculous. We are a very prosperous and affluent society, and for some reason, you know, nobody's ever happy. I guess that's part of the I don't want to say curse, but what comes with being human. But people are so dishonest about money these days, it's ridiculous. One other thing, too, about the stimulus package, which I think, you know, this proposed stimulus package, which is just ridiculous. It's $150 billion, and it's not new money. It's money that's being redistributed that they already had, or money that we had to borrow, and God knows we've done enough of that. And George Bush, you know, I like him for a lot of things, but let's be honest, the man has never had a problem writing a check. So we said, okay, we'll stave off this quote-unquote recession, and I'll give everybody $600. Okay. If you honestly think that giving somebody $600 is going to stave off a recession, that's ridiculous. We're talking about less than $2 a day.
Well, it worked the first time when they gave us all $300. So if it worked once with $300, $600 should be twice as good.
Okay, but then you have Democrats saying, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. We need to put money in the hands of the people. Okay, fine. Why not make
never
a tax
bad idea in election year for a politician anyway.
Yeah, but that's true. But if they go and they say that, why not make the tax cuts permanent? Then you'll put money in the hands of the people.
Yeah, but see, that would go against Democratic principle.
Yeah, I know, but most things that make sense do. I'm just proving a point.
Hey, if you want to have a stimulus package that works, fix the tax code.
Exactly. The tax code is an abomination.
Right.
There's no reason why we can't have a tax code that's maybe one or two pages long.
Right. The tax code would fix the problems, but $600 check, that's the easy button.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Mark about the tax code, because whenever he hears the tax code, he starts salivating, and he has all these grand ideas.
It's the one reason I kind of like Huckabee, actually, is his stance on the tax code, which is get rid of it, you know. I like the Fair Tax Initiative, despite what some people have said negatively about it. A consumption-based tax makes sense because it, especially the way it's structured in the Fair Tax Initiative, a consumption-based tax would not disproportionately tax the poor, and it would bring in new revenue. That is, folks that, you know, this problem we have with illegal immigrants not paying taxes, well, when they buy stuff, it would be built in. You know, that problem goes out the window. We also, you know, we don't have to have TurboTax and 16,000 pages of tax code come out every year. We just you know, pay it at the pump, pay it at the cashier, you know.
I think the reason people frowned at it when Huckabee brought up the fair tax was because he didn't believe it before. He did cut some taxes when he was in Arkansas, but by the time he left office, he had a net tax increase of $500 million. The only reason he brought up the flat tax was because, the fair tax was because he was reading the book on it during the campaign, and he decided that's a good idea, and I will use it as a campaign promise. If he honestly, go ahead.
It doesn't matter to me how he came up with the idea. I mean, it sounds better to me than McCain's thing of simplifying the tax to a couple pages. Yeah, that's cool. But that is a decent idea. But if the fair tax thing were to come across, it's better than anything the left has proposed.
Well, yeah, people are just skeptical whether he means it or not, because of it's a recent. That's all.
Yeah. No, I can. That's a fair thing to say. But you know, governing a state and governing a country are two different things. And if he's making it a plank of his campaign, then I'm inclined to believe it.
I don't know, because I've always thought that, in a sense, governing a state is often a microcosm of governing a country. That's why we tend to elect governors more than we do senators or, you know, representatives, because governors have the executive experience. So you might be partially right, but I think that, you know, being a governor and being a president are, in some ways, they're pretty close.
No, I disagree. I think that they're nowhere close, and the only thing that they have going for them is that they're able to recruit better people for their cabinets because they're at a higher office.
Okay, well, I mean, we're all entitled to our opinion. I just go back and I look at history, and there hasn't been a senator elected as president. You know, there will be now, but there hasn't been one since 1960, I believe. And so I think there's something to that, because people in the legislatures, they just don't connect with people the way that governors or even mayors do in Rudy Giuliani's case.
Well, let me throw another caveat out there, is that it's better to be a senator than it is president of the United States.
Well, you don't have to work if you're a senator. You can vote if you want to, you know. You only work, 100 some days a year.
In terms of being able to put across and actually affect policy, though, I think Bill's got a point there. The president can set the agenda, but there's no guarantees on what's gonna actually come across from the Hill.
Exactly, and the other point is that when you're a senator, like Senator Edward Kennedy, you could pretty well be a senator for life. When you're president, you got 8 years and you're gone, unless you're Bill Clinton. Then you can go back for seconds.
Real hard. I mean, just because, you know, again, just because we're looking at, like, the Democratic race right now, and Obama's going to have a delegate lead, but don't think for a minute that Hillary's not looking at all the superdelegates going, you're going to help us. Or, because, you know, people that don't always get along with the Clintons seem to, disappear or die. I'm just saying, you don't want to cross the Clintons too much, because they have no problem doing exactly what they want to do to get the job done. But we need to be really honest about the Clintons, and whatever building they're in, we just should put crime tape around it, because you know something bad's going on. I don't trust those people any further than I can throw them, and neither should Barack Obama. I think that's what holds him down. He's too nice, and he talks about nothing but hope. And, you know, platitudes. He's probably a great Scrabble player, because he says a lot of words, but none of them really mean anything.
But remember, that is public persona. And what goes behind or goes on behind closed doors a lot of times can be, if you saw those politicians in real life, you'd say, okay, yeah, they're playing hardball. I've witnessed it myself. And it is a difference between the public and the private persona.
Well, yeah. It's just I don't think somebody like Barack Obama, has a lot of substance. If you go and even look at his Illinois Senate voting record in the state house, the majority of his votes, or a large number of them, he didn't vote yay or nay. He voted president, or present, excuse me. Yes, I'm here.
Right. Obama's a better salesperson about his platform than Hillary is.
Tell me what his platform is, Bill.
His platform is hope, and that is better than the same old Clinton BS.
Hope is better than policy.
Hope is better than social welfare and social medicine.
I was going to say, whenever you're talking about what the a Clinton platform, pretty much anything Trump said, and when you're talking about the very palatable platform of Obama, at least what we get from the media, yeah, you have a hard time saying no to hope and yes to socialism. I mean, that's really kind of how it's been framed.
That's right. We'll at least give hope a chance. How's that?
Well, the reality of it, there's actually two phases to it. His platform and her platform are almost identical. But the thing of it is, I'm not sure if anybody really knows that. Because I've seen a bunch of, they show focus groups and stuff on TV after debates, and they talk to Obama people, and they say, name one accomplishment or one position of Barack Obama. I've seen this like four or five times, and not one person can do it. Nobody can do it. They say, raise your hand, and not one hand will go up. And if it does, they'll say something which is nonsensical, like, well, he's the only black senator, you know, in Washington.
Okay, do the same litmus test with Hillary Clinton.
I can name an accomplishment of hers. She spent $1 billion researching medicine.
Medicine and the destruction thereof, but
yeah, there you go.
You know, I've heard Hillary Clinton directly call for universal health care,
and then they tried to sell it to the American people and they lost.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch all that. What was that?
Well, they tried that when Bill Clinton was president. Let's go out. Remember the second term of Bill Clinton? They tried to do that, and it fell on deaf ears. Why do they think that's going to work again?
Because
I think they think it's going to work because it's the only option now. They're presenting the American people with two scenarios, and these are not the only two scenarios that could possibly come out, but these are the scenarios that the American public think exist now. A, you accept socialized medicine, although we're not calling it socialized medicine, we're calling it universal health care.
Yeah.
You accept the hand that's got all the goodies in it, or B, our medical system in America is just going to disappear, and you're not going to have access to it unless you have $1 million a year.
Yeah, which is not true.
That's the picture that has been painted for America. I talk to folks, and there's this very elaborate mythology that's evolved around the public's, you know, the politically aware public's perception of how medicine in America works, and it all involves the solution being socialized medicine. Those that have no political awareness, that just, you know, they what they know of medicine is, you know, whenever they have to go to the emergency room, all they know is that they've got a bill, a bill for $600 that they're not going to ever pay because they don't have the money for it or whatever, and they'd rather trade their credit report for, you know, some health. And they know whenever that starts piling up, hey, you know what, this can't go on. I can't just get medicine and not pay for it. So we might as well go with this socialized medicine thing. So at least the government will pay for it.
It's kind of funny. I mean, we do have socialized medicine. Just go to the emergency room. They have to treat you, and they can't make you pay. I mean, the downside to it, of course, is the emergency room is closed, but there you go. And the sad part of it is, I kind of have, I won't go too deep into it, but I sort of have a personal axe to grind with socialized medicine, because I have a lot of friends up in Canada, and I've seen what it does to people. A friend of mine had to have surgery. She eventually got it, but she was upset because she wasn't well, and she had to wait 6 or 8 months. And I had another friend, unfortunately, who I'll just go ahead and say it. She attempted suicide. And she talked to me. I said, well, if I would have known that, I would have come up there and stayed with you in the hospital. And she said, they didn't admit me into the hospital. And I'm shocked by that. Because here, you attempt suicide, it's immediately, in my town, immediately 7 days in the psych ward. You're in the hospital. They just gave her some pills and turned her loose. And I've had people in America tell me, well, you can't, I don't believe that the socialized medicine is worse than you know, privatized medicine. And I know for a fact that it is, and it destroys people. And in England, I've read things where they've told people to do their best to treat themselves because they just can't afford to treat people. And me, being disabled and being someone who occasionally needs the emergency health care for stitches or broken bones or what have you, I will pay money until I'm broke before I wait in line to die. And no one is ever going to tell me that the government, and I'm not anti-government, some people think I am, but the government is never an answer to a problem. I've heard, there was this saying Ronald Reagan said, the scariest words you could ever hear are, hi, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. So there's no way anyone would ever convince me that socialized medicine or anything of the sort is the way to go.
Okay, final question here. Does the do-nothing Democratic Congress help or hurt the Democratic candidate, or are they just a non-factor? What's your opinion?
I think that it's definitely a hurting factor for, just about everybody. I mean, especially when you got three-fourths of the presidential candidates right now coming from that Congress.
Yeah.
You got the Democrats completely upset over the fact that Pelosi and the Democratic Congress is now completely caving in to President Bush over Iraq. Pelosi just caught. I mean, there's protests out in California right now with the fact that Pelosi has decided to drop the calls for impeachment against the president, and is calling upon other Democrats to stop calling for impeachment. And, of course, the MoveOn.org wing of the party is just up in arms over that. And then, of course, on the Republican side, we've seen the complete collapse of conservatism. Both Art and I have held our heads in our hands and cried over the fact that we've got a Republican president, a Congress full of Republicans, and hardly a single conservative in the bunch.
Yeah, it's a shame.
And to cut taxes, yeah, that's great, but also spend money at twice the rate they're cutting it. And I'm sorry, I don't care who you are, that's not the definition of conservatism, not in my book. So.
And I don't think it is, you know, I don't think it's anyone's definition, at least anyone who has a functioning brain. People always say, well, Ronald Reagan, you know, he reached across the aisle and, you know, worked with Democrats. It wasn't the same thing. He was able to reach across the aisle and show people how conservatism works. He never once compromised his principles in order to accomplish his goals. And I know that, you know, people get tired of us always talking about, you know, President Reagan, but he was it. And it's unfortunate, and it was sad to see all the Republican candidates always bring up the name of Ronald Reagan when you know, in fact, that they weren't. I think, you know, I hope that they learn that it takes more than just inciting his name to convince the conservative base. I mean, even John McCain does that now. I was a Reagan foot soldier. You were not. He never was. He reaches across the aisle more than any senator that I can think of. In fact, if they rank senators by conservatism, he's number 47. And since the Republicans don't have a majority in the Senate, what does that tell you? He's on the bottom. Unfortunately for conservatism, we're in trouble, and we've kind of brought it on ourselves because we were so afraid of the Hillary Clinton presidency. We thought, well, we need somebody who's electable. And it's John McCain because the media loves him. and now we're in trouble. Mark and I think Mark and I essentially agreed that, that Fred Thompson was our last best hope, at least for a while, and he's blew it. So now we are where we are, and we have to see where we go from here.
Guys, it's time to play Ask Bill 3. This is where I'm going to turn the microphone over to you, and you get to ask me three questions about anything, so fire away.
Let's see. So what's your opinion of caucuses, Bill, since you live in a caucus state?
My opinion on caucuses is that it was great in the early 19th century, but now that we've got so much information, we've got so much media, we've got everything else, they really don't play a big role other than stuffing Iowa's economy with dollars from people from out of town, and that's about it.
I think they're ridiculous. I hate to be insulting, but you know, people that participate in caucuses, what, is voting on paper too hard for you people?
Well, the thing about it is it was how it was done 30 years ago, but this is a new world, and do we need it? No. Are they going to get rid of it? No, because the people of Iowa want the money. It's something where I think, especially after the calls and after all the stumping and everything else, most people, average people anyway, say, thank goodness that's over with. So, Mark, what's your opinion of that from Texas?
On the caucusing, I've never really been 100% certain on exactly how that was supposed to work. People get together, they sort of talk about the candidates, and then kind of come up with a consensus. Is that kind of the general overview of how it's supposed to work?
You got it.
Yeah, I don't. You know, call me traditional, or maybe it's liberal. I don't know whichever it is, but I've always preferred writing my candidate's name on a piece of paper and putting it in the box. The caucus system is just, it seems like kind of a circus, and it seems very open to manipulation.
Yeah.
And given the fact that our political system seems fairly open to manipulation, or at least open to accusations of manipulation as it is, with states declaring a winner after only a portion of the votes have been counted.
Yeah.
Like this week.
Like Washington.
You know, I don't think we need to invite any more manipulation into the system.
Yeah, and the thing about caucuses, too, if I may, it's funny because you see they have, two or three rounds of voting. You know, as if one vote, wasn't enough, let's go through it again. And maybe I can persuade you to join my side and you'll vote like me this time instead. You know, if you're going to vote and you're being persuaded at a polling place, or you're having somebody else talk you into it, when you're at the polling place, whatever that polling place may be, you shouldn't vote because you have no spine and you don't know what you want. So just stay home. I mean, I'm already angry too as well about open primaries. You know, you don't have to be a member of a certain party. You just go in and declare, and you could throw your vote in the direction to mess with the other party, and that's not cool either. I think our electoral system has been completely ruined. And this year is a shining example of it.
What's question number two?
Let's talk. I mean, the field is narrowed down quite a bit. Huckabee is the only reason he's in there is to become the vice presidential candidate, or is this a situation where he could actually throw the vote, or maybe possibly even get it in a brokered convention?
I think that he. Unless McCain blows up or has a heart attack or something along the line, I think he's going to have it. Is he a good second banana? Boy, I don't think so. I think the more appealing question is, who's going to be the second banana on the Democratic side? Because Hillary won't want to play second fiddle. And then you've got a scumbag like Richardson that's still out there. You've got Vilsack from Iowa. He's played nice with everybody.
John McCain's the kind of guy who will use somebody like Mike Huckabee, which he has done, because he really took a lot of the conservative vote away from Mitt Romney. But when John McCain is done with Mike Huckabee, he'll throw him under the bus. He'll just chuck him.
I'll bet you McCain picks Lieberman.
Oh, my God.
I've actually heard that a couple times because Lieberman threw his support behind McCain.
Yeah, don't be amazed if that happens.
Yes, and there will be, on election night, there will be about 3 Republican votes when they do the tallying. Because when you look at the election returns now, look at the numbers of Democratic primary votes cast, and look at the number of Republican primary votes cast. The difference is astronomical. So, you know, Joe Lieberman will not be away. As good as he is on, you know, policies like the war, that is not a way to get people to the polls. We already think we're kind of doomed, but if he picks Joe Lieberman, we're dead. It's over.
What's question number 3?
Here's my question. It's a two-parter. What happened to the Republicans, and what will happen to the Republicans? In other words, where did the conservatives go, and are we going to have a conservative party ever again?
Well, I think that the conservatives, what happened to the conservatives is that they stuck with the war, and they stuck with Bush, and, you know, being a big Bush supporter, if you've ever listened to the show, especially the early ones, you know, I was behind our president, and then you find out, there was just this 500-pound weight around your neck if you were with George Bush, and it just slowly unraveled. And I think what is going to happen to the Republicans is what happens in most cases, which is just a natural life cycle. You know, you can only be king of the mountain for so long. You can only be in an up economic market for so long before you even out. And, you know, it's going to be the Democrats' turn for a while unless Hillary Clinton gets in. If the Democrats serve up Hillary Clinton and it's Hillary against McCain wins. If it's McCain against Obama, Obama wins. Unless he picks a real turkey for a second banana. But that's kind of where I think it's going. I think that there's going to be this cycle here for about at least another 8 years where the Democrats are going to be holding the keys to the White House and to Congress, and then it's just going to naturally go the other way for a while. What's your opinion?
Well, I like Art was mentioning earlier, we had really kind of, when the Republicans kind of took the White House and had a majority in Congress, we were thinking, oh yeah, if they press the advantage, man, we could be without the Democrats forever. Some third party could rise through the ranks, and that was before my honeymoon phase with the Libertarians, so I wasn't aware of how disorganized and crazy they were. But now it's past the honeymoon phase with the Libertarians for me, and so I don't see them really coming up and being a successful third party without some serious reforms. Yeah. I don't see the Democrats as ever becoming less, socialist, and I don't see the Republicans moving anywhere but further left. I mean, you plot all the candidates that we have running right now, and a lot of them even before that, on a chart of, you know, where they are on the political spectrum, and they all kind of fall within a few grid spots of each other. The only people that were really off in terms of not being in the same kind of zone on the map were Fred Thompson, Mike Gravel, Dennis Kucinich, and Ron Paul. And, you know, it worked really well for them. You know, let's talk about that. Yeah, I mean, you know, they're no longer hardly a footnote. So just the trends of where politics seems to be heading ideologically, I'm just completely puzzled as to where it's going to end up, you know, 4 years from now. All my kind of prediction models have kind of been shot to hell. So
yeah, it is tough to say. I don't know if I would necessarily put, and this just isn't me shilling, I don't know if I would put Fred Thompson in the same category as, say, a Ron Paul or a Dennis Kucinich.
Well, and I'm not trying to say there any all four of them were off, like, in their own corners as far as, you know, the ideological chart, but they were off the center, which is where everybody else kind of falls.
Yeah. Fred Thompson just did it to himself because if he would have dropped the droopy dog routine, who was sleepy all day, he should have won the Republican nomination in a walk. I think conservatives would have come out for him and just voted astronomically, but the thing I said about him was, I figured it out, he was George Bush in reverse. You know how George Bush is, he's good off the cuff, but if you put cards in front of him, he loses it? Fred Thompson's the opposite. You give him his cards, and, you know, he does his little pre-produced videos, and they're awesome. I remember when I saw his announcement on the internet, my heart just leapt. And then he went to a debate and took some volume or something, and it was just over. And by the time he woke up, it was too late.
Fred Thompson was an actor. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. But nobody ever talks about, you know, how he was a lawyer by trade, and how he shepherded Justice Roberts through the confirmation process. You know, oh, he was just an actor. Yeah.
Well, didn't he prove it, though? I mean, he turned into this unappealing kind of, geez, you know, if I've got to talk to people, I suppose I will, type of candidate. Like it was an imposition.
Yeah, that could be. He was a little tired. I guess for people like me who knew who he was, I didn't need, you know, all of the constant flash and, you know, go get him, because I'd read some of his stuff and watched his things, and I knew what he believed in. Unfortunately, and this has been proven, not everyone is as engaged as I am, excuse me, and I think that was the downfall of it. I didn't need all that, but apparently a lot of people do, because they're too busy watching American Idol or what have you. So I guess you got to go get out there early and grab them quick, which he didn't do. And that's a shame, too, because that's not his fault. The process this year started way too early.
No, but it was his fault that once he got into the ring, he just didn't do anything.
Yeah, since he technically but not really got in late, he didn't hit the ground running, which he should have done. And that's really what did him in. And we didn't talk about Rudy much. He did the same thing. He really didn't campaign in any states until he got to Florida. And then he finished third in Florida and dropped out before Super Tuesday. Why would you do that?
Because it was too hard. He was a Hollywood actor that was spoiled and really did want to put in the effort into being president of the United States. You know, if we would have given it to him, if we would have just, you know, handed him the trophy, he would have said, yeah, you know what, I'll be president of the United States if the people want me to. But, you know, if I got to work at it, you know, I'm really not interested. That's the way he came off.
Yeah, but as I tried to mention earlier, why did Rudy do the same thing? Why did he only really campaign in one state and then drop out before Super Tuesday? That, unless there was a conspiracy there, because Rudy, as he first started to run, he said, "Well, if I wasn't running myself, I would vote for John McCain." So he runs, campaigns in one state, and drops out before Super Tuesday, endorses John McCain. Why would you do that?
I think that he just saw the writing on the wall that no matter what, he wasn't going to win.
Well, it was his to lose, though, because, I mean, before the cycle even started, there were only two people that on the Republican side people were talking about, and one of them was Rudy and the other one was McCain. McCain, people were talking about him because McCain wanted people to talk about him. Rudy was one of those people that there was talk that he was going to get drafted like Colin Powell, you know, if he didn't run.
Right.
And then once he starts running, I don't know, it just all fell apart for him. I don't know if it was disorganization or... I mean, one of the interesting things I did, it was for a series of pieces of Mashable that never actually ran due to just some other major news coming up, but I did a very in-depth profile of the social media presences of all the different candidates. It's a very interesting thing. Obviously, Obama, Edwards, and Ron Paul scored very high on that, as is seen in their fundraising. It was Rudy's online presences very much mirrored his kind of public image in the political space, in so much as like it was all kind of half-assed, and it didn't really know what he was. It didn't really seem like anybody knew what they were doing. Like his blog, for instance, perfect example. One of the few people in the political space in the presidential race that was maintaining a very active blog, occasionally would post to it himself, but you know, very rarely. Problem was, it was riddled with all kinds of stupid technical issues. Like every single blog post going back for over a year was on the same page. So anytime you go to his blog, you have to wait 10 minutes for it to load up. I mean, it's just like, and then finally, right there at the end, he hired like some sort of savvy technical consultant. They created some sort of very complex social networking piece that would have really done well to organize a grassroots effort for him online. And then, you know, a week and a half later, he drops out. Very bizarrely run campaign.
It amazes me, because when you look at Rudy Giuliani and John McCain, in a lot of ways they're similar. But if I had to choose between the two, I would choose Rudy Giuliani, just because Rudy has by far a better temperament than John McCain does. John McCain has a history of using bad language. Well, so do I, but bad language on the Senate floor, and he's been known to get angry enough to throw telephones at people. And I don't know if I want to give the big red button to that guy.
Oh, come on now. It can't be that easy. You know, we heard that about Reagan. It's like, oh, don't want his hand on the button. You know what? It's not that easy, and he's not that stupid. Nobody is.
I'm just saying, he has a lot of temper tantrums, and I'm not actually...
So what? You're not going to blow up the world because you didn't get your muffins?
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but my point is I don't really know if he has the temperament for the office. Never mind the stamina, but I don't know if he has the temperament for the office. And it's funny to me when he stands there and he talks about not being an insider, yet he's been in Washington for 25 or 30 years. You cannot be in Washington for 25 or 30 years and coexist with the other party the way he has and become part of the media the way he has and not be an insider. In fact, if we were going to be honest, the little R at the end of John McCain's name shouldn't be there. It should be an M for Media Party.
The one thing about being a Washington insider is that if you're not one, you'll hire one.
Yeah, I suppose.
And if you don't, then you'll become Jimmy Carter.
I don't know if I wish that on anybody. That's a tough gig.
Mark and Art, do you want to tell a little bit about your projects before we sign off for the evening here?
Sure. Yeah, I'm doing a number of things over at Mashable. We're of course writing quite a bit over there, covering the social media space. That means Facebook, blogging, podcasting, MySpace, pretty much anything that has to do with Web 2.0 or has a buzzword in it, we talk about it. We're also doing a couple of things. I'll give you an exclusive preview here that I'm probably not supposed to talk about, but we're launching an online TV station that's primarily going to consist of me and, at least at the start, it's going to consist of me and the other editors doing our job and occasionally doing some on-screen, you know, news reporting, but also is going to have some other interesting characters from other popular video podcasts showing up there as well. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the audio podcast is an interview series called Mashable Conversations, where we just kind of interview CEOs and other people that are running certain, you know, viral campaigns or companies in the Web 2.0 world. We just had Will.i.am, the guy that did that silly little Obama music video. He was on the show this week, and we had the guy that runs the Choose or Lose from MTV's little political thing on there a couple weeks ago. So listen to it long enough, you find something interesting for just about any demographic. So
yeah.
That's what I'm doing. Art is Art. What are you doing?
I'm as far as web goes, I'm kind of on a bit of a hiatus right now. Other than my blog, you know, artlindsay.com, I don't have a lot going on. I usually, you know, Mark is always coming to me and saying, we could do this and we could do that, and stuff doesn't always seem to pan out. And so we're kind of in a holding pattern, you know, as far as that stuff goes. Other than my blog, as far as the internet goes, I don't have a lot going on. But I do imagine before too long we'll have found something where possibly, maybe, someone will make a promise and keep it, which which would be neat.
There's barely 6 months that go by before that Art and I aren't involved in some project together, so he'll be doing something with me here soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll be enslaved doing something and for a nominal amount of money, but such is my life.
Hey, guys, it's been wonderful. You've been great guests. It's been a very compelling conversation, and I thank you once again for being our guests on You Are the Guest.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having us.
If you'd like to drop me a comment about this week's show, just email me at BillGrady@YouAreTheGuest.com. That takes care of this week's show from the great city of Fort Dodge, Iowa. I'm Bill Grady. Thanks for listening.